From the Sky News Centre at 5, the Lib Dems claim their result in the Richmond Park by-election is a historic moment. They say it's a protest vote against Brexit. Annie Joyce reports.
Sarah Jane Olney is duly elected.
Even the Lib Dems were surprised.
It's obviously unexpected.
Party leader Tim Farron says their victory sends a clear message.
So the British people did not vote for a hard Brexit.
London's Labour mayor agrees.
The results in Richmond Park are a wake-up call.
These locals blame Zach Goldsmith campaigning to leave the EU.
People are angry about it.
We're anti-Brexit, so if you're going to be pro-Brexit, then you're not for us.
There's another by-election in Lincolnshire next week.
Formula One world champion Nico Rosberg has announced his retirement from the sport just days after his maiden title. The 31-year-old German driver says he achieved his dream and feels ready to quit. The German says it put an end to a tough year for him.
I really gave it everything I had. I didn't leave a stone unturned. And I'm not willing to do that again for next year. And so, yeah, so I've decided to call it a day, stop racing here. Just following my heart, you know, you just live once. So my heart is telling me to do this and it just feels completely right.
A man described as the enforcer for a notorious London crime family has been sentenced to 9 years in jail for shooting an associate. Patrick Adams avoided a trial for attempted murder after admitting a lesser charge. A former Chelsea player claims the Premier League side paid for his silence over alleged sexual abuse. The club has refused to comment. 17 UK police forces are looking into historical claims within the sport. Train passengers are facing the biggest rail fare increase in 3 years. From January, they'll go up by 2.3% on average. And tributes have flooded in for the Fawlty Towers star Andrew Sachs. The actor's died at the age of 86. Former co-star John Cleese says he couldn't have found a better Manuel. That's the latest. I'm Elizabeth Williams.
It's Friday, folks. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling, helping me review this week's news. It's the leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council and councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Mark Weston. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, all along the watchtower of Bristol's city walls, a new series on authoritarian Britain examining the building blocks of the police state being assembled around us. Briefing three tonight, with nearly 30 Tory MPs facing charges of election fraud from May 2015. Did the Conservative Party steal last year's general election? And what happens now to Cuba with the death last weekend of Cuba's king, Fidel Castro? Can the country hold the ideals of the revolution? And come to think of it, what's the difference between a monarchy and a dictatorship ruled by dynasty? Aren't they really just two ways of saying the same thing? Jackie Cannon joins me to go through Cuba's history and look at the prospects for the future. Plus, as we do every week, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 5 degrees Celsius, some light rain this weekend, highs of 8, if you can call it high. Plenty of sunny spells, but feeling cold. Next week, highs of 14 Celsius, warming up a bit as the week progresses. A fairly cloudy week with some sunshine and a few showers. Next weekend, the 10th and 11th of December, highs up to 11 Celsius. Actually down from 14 Celsius during the week, but sunshine and showers next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And before I introduce Mark Weston, I'm also joined this evening by Sean Murphy. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Sean, I know you used to work at Bristol University as a manager in the medical faculty up there. You're now part of something called Protect Our NHS. What is it?
Protect Our NHS is a campaigning group based in Bristol and the surrounding area. And we campaign to protect the NHS by fighting against cuts to the budget and privatisation of the service.
So how are you actually
managing to do that? Because actually, at the end of the day, you can't. It's down to the government and the Department of Health to decide how much money goes, and you can't do anything about that.
Well, we keep raising the issues all the time, and we find that the majority of people we talk to are not in favour of government policy. They want to preserve the NHS the way it is, and they don't like, most people don't like, the fact that parts of it are being privatised.
Privatisation, now that's not what the Conservatives would call it, is it, Mark? Privatisation of the health service. What's happening, it seems, is that private businesses are being bought in and are able to bid effectively for contracts. Is that right?
Well, in some areas, I mean, it's not just private business. You've also got charity groups, you've got third sector groups. And I really do push back a bit of privatising the NHS. The vast majority of the NHS, we're talking about 92% of the budget, is still in NHS hands. The rest of it, well, it began under Labour with Andy Burnham in, I think it was 2007, and actually the rate slowed under the Conservatives. So I really think I push back at the idea that the Conservatives are somehow going to privatise what many of us actually like and enjoy, which is the NHS.
So just give us an idea of how your group operates, Protect Our NHS, Sean.
Well, we have street stalls regularly every week in different parts of Bristol. We attend the local clinical commissioning group meetings, which is the body, the NHS body, which takes the decisions about commissioning and recommissioning new health services, and read their papers. And we are in touch with local MPs. And we are part of a national network of similar groups around the country.
These clinical commissioning groups, most of us haven't got the time to go to them. What happens there? What have you seen when you go along to these meetings?
Well, they're like board meetings of any organisation. And the most important things they talk about are what they're going to do when the contract for a particular health service is coming to an end, how they're going to recommission that service, what the new service is going to look like, and who is likely to bid for it.
What about you personally? What made you get involved with this campaign?
Well, I think that the National Health Service is something that the vast majority of people in this country are very grateful for. And what is happening at the moment, what has been happening for many years now, is that the government is chipping away at the NHS in such a way that the service as it was originally is not there anymore. And to go back to what was just said about privatisation, it's true that only about 10% of NHS services are privatised at the moment, but the trajectory, the way things are going, is that it is increasingly being taken over by private companies who are being given contracts to run NHS services.
What about this week's announcement, these plans for the country? Apparently they were going to be very secretive. What have they announced this week? Something called STP, Sustainability and Transformation Plans, right across the country. What does it look as like across the country, and what about specifically here in Bristol?
Well, these plans have been produced across the whole of England in 44 different areas. The main purpose of this plan, from the point of view of the government, is to limit spending on the NHS over the next few years. Everybody knows that the service at the moment is under a lot of pressure, and what the government wants to do is cap the budget by £23 billion in a few years' time, so that in a few years' time the service is going to be even worse than it is now. Even if the government increased the spending by £23 billion, that would still not return spending on the NHS to the average spending on health in Western European countries. Another £20 billion would be required for that. So the government is trying to limit the budget to the point where increasingly people are going to be saying individuals have got to pay for their health here. They've got to pay for visits to GPs, they've got to pay for this particular procedure, or they've got to take out personal health insurance on top of the taxes that they're paying for.
Well, hang on, because that's not happening now. What about now? What effects have been felt over the way that the health service has been dealt with really since the 2010 election? What is happening now? I know that there have been certain fingers being pointed at accident and emergency particularly, saying, well, that actually emergency services, particularly this time of the year in the winter, just simply cannot cope. And also a lot of GP surgeries closing.
Well, yes, everybody knows that the situation is not good at the moment. Waiting lists are getting increasingly long. There's enormous pressure on GP surgeries. And in this situation, to come up with plans which are going to limit NHS spending even further is just going to lead to a degraded service.
Mark, what do you make of this whole idea of having a market in healthcare? Do you think it's a good idea to have these clinical commissioning groups where you've got doctors who are really trained to look after patients, whether be surgeons or GPs, looking at people's medical complaints, actually poring over vast piles of commercial bids? I mean, is it really the same skill set that someone needs to do one job and the other?
Well, I actually am in favour of clinical groups because I actually want the people that are making decisions about my health and the care that I receive to have control over the budget. I think that's a better, more responsive service. I mean, the NHS budget overall is growing. I mean, this is one of the problems here. You know, it was 116 billion last year. It's going up to about 133
but
billion.
Hang on, because I mean, you missed my point, I think, there, because surely it's not a doctor doesn't have the skill set to go through the fine print of a contract to see which contract is another one.
Hold on, the doctor won't go through the fine print. That's why they'll have legal advisors and business advisors. The doctor will make the decision on where he thinks the best care is going to come from. That doctor, the one that is the expert that I go and see about my health, I think should be the one that makes that decision. The fine print in the detail, that'll be gone over by lawyers. They're not going to sit there with a fine tooth comb. That's not their job. Their job is to make a decision about my health.
There is some estimates of the amount that the having a market in health in Britain is costing. We reported last week that it's around about £30 billion has been wasted of NHS spent on this market system. It was investigated by the Lib Dems back in 2014.
I'm sure that was a balanced report.
I can read you some of it if you want. But, it does seem that this is a massive extra cost that people are having to bear, which can't be spent on nurses, can't be spent on medicines, can't be spent on wards.
No, I'm sorry. A report done by political opponents of the government finds the conclusion that was against the government's decision. That is not news. He who pays the piper calls a tune. I'm afraid I accept that there might well be problems, but I'm not going to take absolutely at face value something the Lib Dems have drafted.
Well, it's a journalist, Caroline Malloy,
that
did the report. No, it's not. It's for a website called Our NHS. And she was picking up on research that the Lib Dems had done and really, sort of teasing out some of the figures. It was at this point in 2014, there was the NHS Confederation calling for £75 a night hotel fees for hospital stays in order to try and address some of the deficit in the health service.
Let's be honest about it. The NHS is going to have to change. Now, we can argue about the direction in which it's changed, but we're ageing population. There were more challenging, more expensive medicines. We know things are going to have to adapt if we're going to meet the future. The reality is the NHS could absorb an unlimited amount of spending, but that kind of money means we'd have to cut back on everything else. We have to try and reduce the demand so people that aren't going into hospital or A&E when they don't need to. They're not bothering the GP if they don't need to, so might be going to see the pharmacist or something. We have to find a way to do this, to combat it. We're going to have to work differently if the NHS, which we want it to, is going to survive into the future.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, we started with the NHS just after the Second World War when things like the Blitz, the bombed out buildings were still very fresh in people's memories. The idea being that the last thing you wanted to ask was whether someone had health insurance if they were pulled out of a burning building.
Well, I think that's right. I think the NHS has always been, it was conceived initially as a top-down plan. As a result of the Second World War, where top-down planning had seemed to work. And I think that there has been a fundamental failure of imagination with the creation of the purchaser-provider split in the health service, where we've created a pseudo-market. It isn't really a market. It's a pseudo-market. It's a pretend market, because the ideology behind it is that markets are always more efficient than top-down planning. And I would suggest that the NHS demonstrates in its cost-effectiveness, because it's still the most cost-effective system in Europe and in the world, even with its slightly marketised aspect that it's now got, is because it is a top-down plan, and it's not an insurance-based system as you've got in other European countries.
I'm sorry, again, I'm pushing back in a friendly and respectful manner, of course. Some of the NHS is woefully inefficient. Margaret Hodge did her book. She was a Labour MP, I think, on the Public Audit Committee in House of Commons. And she was talking about the 41 NHS trusts order something like 641 different kinds of latex surgical gloves.
That's because there shouldn't be NHS trusts, though, Mark. There should have been a top-down plan. NHS trusts are part of the fragmentation of the service, aren't they?
Are you telling
me? You're making my point for me.
No, what I'm saying is the NHS... But the thing is, this was actually dates back before. I mean, you have a lot of inefficiency. There needs to be a way to make this money spread better. One NHS trust alone had 177 different kinds of latex gloves. You know, they order 22 types of different...
Well, one of the big expenditures... One of the big expenditures is on drugs. And the logic of... And we're actually paying a large amount to what are essentially oligopolistic private drug corporations.
So
and the logic should
the
be that you nationalise those drugs corporations. And it's been pushed for by developing countries that they should be able to develop their own generic basis of drugs which are not patent protected by the patent laws which the multinational corporations insist upon.
If you nationalise the drug industry, if you have it so that you decide, a committee decides on where the drug money goes, if you decide to scrap patents, then you will take investment out of medicinal research.
Well, you'd have to... The point is that the whole of medical industry, if we want to call it an industry, should be actually run for public benefit and not private profit. As it is, for example, in Cuba.
Isn't there a bit of a problem here with this, Mark, in that this is being touted as though we're putting this sustainability and transformation plan for the health service out for consultation, but actually this is pretty much a final plan and they've already done most of the thinking that's behind it. It's not really, it's a sham of a consultation.
I disagree. I could see where the argument comes from though. I mean, to be honest, the STP itself, it isn't much of a plan. I mean, this kind of plan has been drafted by the NHS, I think in 2004 was the last version I've looked at. And you kind of look at it now and going, well, you're saying almost the same things. You didn't do it then. Will you do it now? But it's also very light on detail. It comes up with some of the high-level numbers and figures and aspirations. But actually, how that will be turned into practice at the sharp end, we simply don't know. I mean, that will need to be fleshed up quite dramatically, I think, before we actually see this come forward. And there's going to have to be a lot more public consultation, I think.
Will the Department of Health listen, Sean?
I was at the special meeting of the scrutiny committees of Bristol City Council, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire Councils yesterday, and every councillor that spoke at that meeting complained about the lack of consultation over the production of this plan. Not just lack of consultation with the patients and public, which is a legal duty, but even lack of consultation with the councillors on the scrutiny committees.
And the lack of content in it, I would say.
And there was no support amongst local councillors at that meeting yesterday for this plan.
Mark, what's the point of electing local councillors if they're not going to be listened to? Central government's just going to impose it on us anyway.
Well, and this is actually NHS. It's actually slightly separate from local government. The NHS and local government are different bodies. I do think the NHS, certainly when it comes to public consultation, should talk to, particularly because local councils have increasingly a social care element, and actually we need to make sure the NHS and social care join up. The plan is weak because I think it's so light on detail, and it's going to be very hard to have any meaningful consultation when you actually don't have any detail to consult on. That's my big problem with it.
Okay. Also, this topic came up at Prime Minister's Questions this week on Wednesday. But this particular thing, this SDP, which they're all trotting out now as if everyone's heard of it forever, even though it only seems to have appeared on the scene this week. This is this new plan for the health service discussed on Wednesday.
Margaret Greenwood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The SDP for Cheshire and Merseyside aims to develop accountable care organisations. This is a model from America where they're used to deliver private, insurance-based healthcare. Can the Prime Minister assure me that they won't be used as a means to introduce insurance-based private healthcare into the NHS?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
What the SDPs are about is about people have in a local area determining the shape of health services in that local area in terms of delivering the best service for local people. That's what those are about. Obviously, every area will be looking very closely at the plans that are being brought forward. What is important, I think, is that we do see in those SDPs increasingly health services working with local authorities to ensure that they are providing the right holistic level of care for people in their area.
Martin, accountable care organisations could be insurance by the back door.
Well, that's what the Speaker, who is questioning the Prime Minister, whose name I didn't quite catch, was making that point. I mean, the thing about the NHS is that if you don't have a comprehensive system, then you don't have a comprehensive system. And what chipping away at it and changing aspects of the way it works to make it more market-friendly is, in fact, ill-conceived, because it's not a market system. It's designed not to be a market system. That's why, in fact, we spend less on GDP, in GDP terms, on health than many other developed countries, although we get a better bang for our buck, because we don't have a market-based system. And, of course, that puts us. The NHS is the only one of its kind in the world. Other developed countries don't have it. And of course, the argument is, well, why aren't we more like Germany? Why aren't we more like France? Well, they get better outcomes, but they spend a lot more because they've got insurance-based systems. Ours isn't an insurance-based system where individuals take out insurance. It's a comprehensive system that just deals with ill health, and that's the fundamental principle, which is gradually being undermined.
Okay, we'll hear from you in a second, Mark. But another clip from Prime Minister's questions now.
Stephen Hepburn. I know the Prime Minister has handed happy briefs to read out, but can I tell her she's been wrong on the National Health Service for weeks now? If she came to South Tyneside Hospital, she would see services closing. She would see patients worried. She would see staff demoralised. So when is she going to get a grip of those bean counters who are committing criminal damage to the people's cherished service in her name?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
There are nearly 30 more doctors and over 950 more nurses in the South Tyneside NHS Foundation Trust compared to 2010. This year, the South Tyneside Clinical Commissioning Group will be getting an increase of funding, and the health funding in the Right Honourable Gentleman's area is going to be this year £2.7 billion, and that will be increasing by 2020-21. It is this government that is putting more money into the National Health Service. It is the Labour Party, it's a former shadow health secretary on Labour Party, who said that more money for the NHS was irresponsible.
Talk of bean counters there, Mark Weston, leader of the Tory group on Bristol City Council. Surely that is something the Conservatives hate, that kind of thing.
What, having someone scrutinising the budget?
Bean counters is what they're talking about.
Yeah, you don't want an overabundance of them, but you do actually like some financial experts in there checking stuff out. Of all the issues I think we could pick up on the NHS, I think actually having a few accountants checking the numbers probably isn't the one.
Okay, so anyway, what's your reaction to that then? Closing, I mean, this is South Tyneside, admittedly, but closing facilities, worried patients, demoralised staff.
Yeah, I mean,
this isn't a very good management of the health service, is it? The Conservatives are doing it.
Well, actually, I don't know South Tyneside, so I don't know how that area is getting managed. I don't know what its budget is. I can't really comment on it.
Well, it's 2.7 billion, apparently.
All
it's 2.7 billion.
The total NHS budget is going up. Now, you could argue it goes up more, but you can't argue it's being cut, because it is going up. And it has gone up since 2009-10.
Sean, how do you answer that one?
Well, it's just not going up enough. It's going up a very small amount. It's not going up enough. And we're fortunate in this area that the plans in the STP, to the extent that there's any detail there, they're not as bad as in some other areas of the country. And what you're going to see over the coming months is increasing demonstrations and increasing dissatisfaction amongst people, particularly in those areas where they're proposing hospital closures, A&E closures, and the closure of other services. And over the next 6 months, I think this is an absolutely critical period for the NHS, because either there will be a strong public revolt against what the government is trying to do, or the government will engineer a situation where they will leave the door open for further privatisation and for people having to pay directly for their healthcare.
I mean, Martin, one of the things we know is that a massive amount now is going, something like, I think it was 8% of the budget locally at the North Bristol Trust, towards these PFI deals. So it's all very well having a nice brand spanking new Southmead Hospital, but vast amounts of money is going straight to the city for the loans to build it, because actually they were quite high, relatively expensive loans to build these PFI projects.
Well, I'm sure Mark will remind us that it was the Labour government that brought these
actually
in.
I'm reminding you, yeah.
I accept that, and it was wrong when Labour did it, and it's wrong when the Tories. Well, what's happened is we've lost sight of the fundamental principles of the NHS. It is cheaper and more efficient precisely because it isn't a market, and the attempt to produce a pseudo market is simply wrong. And we know under the 30-year rule now, because we got the papers from the cabinet of Margaret Thatcher's first cabinet, that they openly discussed, we will have to bring in an insurance, we want to bring in an insurance system, this will mean the end of the NHS. It's actually in the document. Now, of course, that caused a row in the cabinet, and Thatcher had to back down because other ministers weren't going to accept it. But it was definitely a goal back in the 1980s. I think the sons and daughters of Thatcher who are now running the country still believe in getting rid of the NHS by stealth, if nothing else.
Mark, come on.
Yeah, no, come on. We've been having Labour saying Conservatives are privatising the entire NHS since 1983, I think, was the one. The fact of it is, you know, 8% of it has maybe gone into private or charitable or third sector hands, again begun under Labour, so excuse me if I point a little hypocritical finger there. Look, for me, the ideological purpose behind the NHS, it should be free at the point of delivery and provide good care. And actually, how that happens, I am not wedded to any specific delivery model. I think it needs to provide good care and be free to those that need it. That, to me, is the underlying premise of the NHS.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that it should be free at the point of delivery, because I think a lot of your colleagues don't actually agree with that. I've got a friend who's lived in Germany for a number of years, and he pays for his health insurance, and at the moment he's paying £7,000 a year. I think there are a lot of people in this country who don't realise just how expensive it is when you have to pay for your own health insurance. And if people don't pay more attention to what's going on, that's the way we're going.
It also came up
in the autumn
in the autumn statement. There's Jeremy Corbyn pretty much saying it for me there. In the autumn statement, there was no new money apparently for the NHS or for social care. And this is what I want to look up after this clip again from Prime Minister's questions.
Statement last week, the Chancellor spoke for over 50 minutes. During that time, he didn't once mention the National Health Service or social care. 1.2 million people are lacking the care they need. Why was there not one single penny more for social care in the autumn statement?
Prime Minister!
There is absolutely no doubt that the social care system is under pressure. We recognise that. There are, if you just look, at the fact that there are 1 million more people of aged over 65 today than there were in 2010, we see the sort of pressures on the social care system. But that's why the government has already acted to put more money into the social care system. More money through the Better Care Fund, 3.5 billion extra through the Better Care Fund, and more money through the social care precept. But it's also important that local authorities and NHS work together to ensure, for example, that people have the social care they need so they're not ending up blocking beds in hospital. There's some very good practice up and down the country, and sadly there's some not so good practice. What we need to do is make sure everybody is giving the best possible service to people who need it.
Is that happening, Mark?
Yeah, the NHS budget is going up. As I said, it's gone from $116 billion last year. It's going to go up to $133 billion by the end of the decade. It is going up. It could go up by more. I mean, the NHS can take in an unlimited amount of money, but it is actually going up. And, I get slightly irate when people say, oh, well, it's being cut. It isn't. I mean, there is a lot of smoke and mirrors. And I think part of the problem is that all of us are passionate about the NHS and we want it to do well, we want it to carry on into the future. What we argue about sometimes is the delivery model by which it happens.
A colleague of mine went to the board meeting of the North Bristol Trust, the South Mead Hospital Trust, about a week ago, and amongst the board papers was a paper saying that nearly one quarter of the beds at South Mead Hospital are occupied by people who should be in the community but for whom there is no proper social care in the community. And that's one aspect of what is going on at the moment. The social care situation is an absolute disgrace, and it's causing, as well as causing pain and misery for the people who aren't getting the care that they should be getting, it's causing massive problems for hospitals because beds are being taken up by people who don't need those beds.
Yeah, this is bed blocking, isn't it, Mark? Why has central government done absolutely nothing about that in this autumn statement? And why is it that the, you know, facilities in hospitals are being taken up by people who shouldn't be there simply because there's not enough money for the local authority, like here at Bristol City Council, to care for those people?
The autumn statement isn't the budget. The budget happens earlier in the year. So in that budget, when we had it, I think it was March, I forget the exact date now, so much has happened politically in the last 8 months. I think it was March. That's when a large injection of cash was laid out. There wasn't any in this one, but you're not going to have everything change every 6 months. I think sometimes you need to have an economic stability in it. So the autumn statement is always meant to be a responsive budget.
But we've closed the elderly people's care homes, and now are saying that, oh, it's okay, it's cheaper to actually look after these people at home, but then the money's not there to do that. So, I mean, this is just bad management, isn't it? And it's actually quite cruel.
No, I don't agree with you on that. There is more money going into social care now than there was. I think we do need to put more money in it. I would agree with you on that. How that happens, I'm afraid I'm not a health expert on it. But no, we do need to put more in. We do need to get more support. Bed blocking is a problem because you don't want to keep people in hospitals because that's where all the germs are.
Well, that's exactly the point Sean's making. Sean,
but there is more money going
having in. Been along to had a look at this STP, wonderful sustainability and transformation plan for Bristol and surrounding area, which is North Somerset and South Gloucestershire too, what's your take home about what we can expect? I mean, I know they haven't given us a lot of detail, but you know, in a nutshell.
Well, it is very difficult to say because the plan does lack detail. Everybody who's looked at the plan, including the councillors who were at the special meeting yesterday, everyone agrees that it's very difficult to say what the plan is going to mean because it says it wants to save 300 million, but it gives very little detail about how it's going to do that other than looking in certain areas like Weston, the hospital at Weston, and thinking a bit more about how they can save some money.
Seems the obvious thing to do, Martin, is to start selling off assets, maybe.
Well, I think in the widest sense, this is one of the most important things that we do. Health is probably the most important thing that people have. Wealth is a very secondary thing. And I often say, well, you know, people say, oh, we don't want to spend any more money on social care for looking after people when they become, you know, elderly and frail and so on. I think, well, what else are you going to spend your money on? What else is the most important thing in your life? And we've got to get a sense of how important this is. And I believe in Scotland, someone will correct me if I'm wrong, that they made the decision years ago that people wouldn't have to sell their houses, for example, in order to pay for when they were looked after when they were old. And of course, that's partly because the fiscal settlement in Scotland is more generous than for England.
And they still have a ballooning deficit.
Yeah, well, that's another question. But, I mean, the fact is, in a wider sense, having a decent health service is a fundamental thing. And when the health service was first brought in the 40s, what it gave everybody was peace of mind. You can imagine what it's like if you live in poor areas of the United States of America and you have no health insurance. You cannot be ill. And if you are ill, there's nothing you can do about it.
Well,
that causes all sorts of mental illness with people worrying about getting ill and all of that. And it's just it's a false economy to think that we shouldn't spend, you know, we should spend whatever's necessary to get the level of care that we desire.
I can remember seeing back in the 1980s, Mark, Duke of Edinburgh saying that the NHS is a sacred cow. And, you know, as if, well, actually, why can't we do something about this? Because we're not allowed to do anything about it. It just looked now as if the situation in the NHS is starting to really deteriorate, really since 2010.
Well, I think one of the problems
the Health and Social Care Act.
I think one of the problems is anytime anyone tries to talk about the NHS and actually have a meaningful conversation about how we make it fit for purpose of the 21st century, when we have a changing demographic, an aging population, anytime that tries to happen, certainly as a Conservative, we're immediately accused of, oh, you just want to privatise it and sell it off to all your banking friends, etc., etc. And so the whole conversation starts to bog down. We do need to have a genuine discussion with clinical groups, with doctors, nurses, particularly with the public, about how this is going to work going forward, because it should be a sacred cow, and the fact that we want it to continue for our children, our grandchildren, etc., on and on. There needs to be a tough conversation had. But I would just say this. You know, if you want to put more money into the NHS, that's fine, but you need to cut something. Now, you said you cut Trident. That's a one-off injection. you know, if you want to look at it, you're going to have to find something substantial. So where would your knife fall?
As I suggested earlier, of nationalising the drug companies, because that's where a lot of the money goes.
Well, at that point, you start losing any drug investment.
Then the government has to take that whole thing over. It's not run up for private profit
at
all.
I don't fancy living in a communist
state. That's a whole other rabbit. We'll be doing the communist states after the news.
In Cuba, that's exactly what they do.
And their economy's doing wonderful.
Anyway, thanks very much for joining us, Sean Murphy from Protect Our NHS. Maybe you can just tell us whereabouts people can find your group, basically in real reality and in virtual reality.
So we meet the first and third Tuesday every month. At the moment, the meetings are held at the YHA, the Youth Officers Association, at the waterfront. Starts at 7:30, and we've got a blog. And if you just Google "Protect Our NHS," you'll find it.
Or your own favourite search engine, not necessarily Google. Talking of which, the Snooper's Charter, Her Majesty, is that the right terminology,
Her
Mark?
Majesty,
yes,
yeah.
Her Majesty signed her little signature on the bottom of the Snooper's Charter this week. And rather than go into any more depth, we've been covering it the last few weeks about how disgusting and awful, appalling this Act of Parliament is, snooping on journalists, on lawyers, and possibly not MPs, but possibly MPs as well, usually using the sort of tactics that it looks as if have been used criminally in the past and now making them lawful. Cassette Boy has had a go and had a look at the Snooper's Charter in this little cut-up. I think we'll have a listen to that now.
A new law is here that causes decent people to live in fear. A new power that allows us to get your browsing history from the internet. But let's not forget this will affect everybody and it will protect nobody. But I can inspect anybody who disagrees with me. That's why I want to spy on everyone all the time. Some people say that's fine, but every time you go online, every email you sign, I'll be watching you. And my message to the haters, I want your communications data. As our power will extend, politicians and their friends can manipulate it for their own ends. Every text you send, every Facebook friend, I'll be watching you.
Can't you see? Your mobile phones will all belong to me. Everyone you call, anyone at all, every day, in every way, Theresa May and I will be watching you. We will look after you. Wherever you turn, we will be right behind you. We will not let you live in private. We will use everything at our disposal to find out about you and your family, and we will never forget what we found.
This is my position. I don't need reasonable suspicion, but if you sign online petitions, expect the Spanish Inquisition.
Think of your own smartphone. It's no longer the no-go zone. It's under attack because we will have all the technology you own. What can I see with these new abilities? For me, the answer is straightforward. It's your supermarket rewards and your National Health Service records. It's all the information you give to any corporation. Every conversation, in every situation, every communication, every website you use, everything you do, every day, in every way, Theresa May and I will be watching you.
That's Cassette Boy there with his little cut-up about, with David Cameron and Theresa May about the Snooper's Charter. Mark, what's the real justification for this? Do you support it?
Yeah, I do, actually, and I'm actually quite shocked. I know you were giggling while that was playing, but for those that are listening, actually, what was just played on that music is not what's happening.
It's called satire, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, but you're a news programme. What this aims to do, it doesn't look at the actual pages you're looking at. It looks at the communication trends, and it's trying to plot out where cyber terrorism, where extremism, where crime is being planned in a digital age. We have to update our surveillance intelligence powers because everything is moving online now. It's not a case of watching Poirot and hoping we'll find the smoking gun and the butler did it. It's now in cyberspace. It's in the dark web. It's looking at where people are going.
So it's okay to snoop on people with no suspicion?
No, hold on. Sorry. The intelligence agencies aren't. What's going to happen is the communication company is going to have to keep a record of the where you visited for a year, they can only access it, the intelligence agents can only access it, if they actually have approval by a judge. So they have to prove suspicion in order to access that information. It isn't a case of suddenly a policeman can wander in and have a look at the browser history. That's not the way it works. It's trying to root out people that want to blow us up. And if you have a way to monitor the internet that keeps us safe, then say so. But the fact is, you don't. These are communicating in the dark web, and we have to move into a digital age.
Well, what about the evidence that's, to a certain extent, anyway, the intelligence services are involved in some of these terrorist attacks? I mean, for example, we did a story a few weeks ago about the schoolgirls from London who were smuggled down to Syria by someone who was working for the Canadian intelligence services. That's our own taxpayers' money from Canada, admittedly, not from the UK, being used to actually help recruit for ISIS. We can't entrust these kinds of things to the intelligence services, surely.
Look, I'm really sorry. You're talking about
they've got no proper scrutiny.
You're talking about an entirely different intelligence service to the one that we're talking about. I'm talking about MO5, MI6. I'm not talking about the Canadian intelligence services. They'll have their own operation. Now, I don't know the story you said. I'm being very surprised if that was
Okay, let me just explain briefly. It was the Turkish police arrested a guy who was a former army officer in the Syrian Arab Army. Yeah. He, it turned out, was working for the Canadian Intelligence Service. Now, they were keeping an eye on him, quite clearly, but to what extent do intelligence services recruit people to keep an eye on them? To what extent are they actually
like
involved in terrorism themselves?
So it sounds like... Yeah, but what... sorry, in your own thing, you've just said it probably wasn't sanctioned by the Canadians. It was probably someone that he did off his own bat.
No, it was sanctioned by the Canadians.
Oh, well, I'm sorry. I don't agree with that.
Well, I mean, the Turkish MIT... MIT is the Turkish Intelligence Services. They are our allies. And they have been involved in supplying ISIS and Al-Qaeda in Syria with weaponry and recruits.
Again, you're talking about an intelligence service that isn't our intelligence
service. It's part of NATO, Mark, and we're part of NATO.
Let's try a possibly more fruitful tack here, which is, are you satisfied, Mark, that the intelligence services get enough scrutiny from people like you, from elected politicians?
Well, they won't get it from me. I'm not high enough up the food chain. But actually, yes, in the House of Commons, yes, I am.
The Intelligence and Security Committee?
Yes.
Because there are whole parts of the intelligence services. I mean, they really have to know what to look for to know how to scrutinise them. They can't just simply wander around looking at this, that and everything else.
The Intelligence Scrutiny Committee isn't one you just wander in as a freshman. You go in there and you get the experience and the training. Now, they're not going to sit there and go through everything in minute detail. They'll pick it out. They can't do everything. That's not their job.
This is all,
but
I suppose...
I am absolutely satisfied that they have enough scrutiny on them.
This
now,
is all...
there will always be an element where things go rogue. There always will be. But the reality is that our intelligence services keep us safe, and we need to make sure they have the tools to do it in a changing age.
I think the people who keep us safe are the police force. And the police force, for example, the West Midlands police put on trial a Swedish citizen, a Muslim, planning to go to Syria and take part in the uprising in Syria. His defence lawyers argued at the Old Bailey some while ago that in actual fact he was going to work with a group that was armed and trained by British intelligence and MI6. And he got off because the police wanted to arrest him for being a terrorist sympathiser, but it turned out that he was actually been recruited by our own intelligence services, MI6. And I have to tell you, in the Middle East, MI6 is not regarded as a completely bona fide organisation that just goes around helping old ladies across the road.
No, of course,
and nor is the CIA in Latin America or in the Middle East. And I would argue that the independent police forces of the world need to look much more closely at what intelligence services actually do. And that's what actually happened in Turkey. The local police arrested the person, but found out that he was actually working with NATO intelligence services.
And had been involved in getting London school kids, 15, 16 years old, down into Syria. Unbelievable, really. But there you go.
And
these people operate in secrecy.
Our police services are also increasingly having to deal with things like cybercrime. So they recognise the problems that are happening on the internet, and they're trying to deal with it. And our intelligence services need to do the same. We need to stop the scaremongering on this. We need to make sure that we are actually safe in a changing era.
That's why we need to have the police
in charge of what's going on so that the intelligence services can't pull the wool over the eyes of the civilian police force.
Well, local police services can't act internationally. Now, whoever's putting stuff on the internet, whoever's going around the world, they can be anywhere. They can be in a shack in Afghanistan. Mm. They aren't necessarily sat in a bedsit in Weston-super-Mare. The local police force aren't the place to deal with this.
There is another, we should wrap up in a minute, but a final side of this, Mark, is that this sort of power could be abused and has been abused by other governments in the past to use it as a way to attack the political opposition so that the security services allied with one political party or another powerful faction within the country can use those that information gained, whether it's through lawyers, etc.
We're not talking about other countries. We're talking about our country. We have the rule of law. We have a democratically elected government. We have a democratic institution that is not that fragile. I think that is scaremongering.
Well, I mean, the Garda Síochána in Ireland...
not our country.
Oh, yes, it's six counties of it still are, I think you'll find.
That's Northern Ireland,
yeah,
not Ireland.
But, all right, but the Garda Síochána uncovered the Dublin and Monaghan bombs of 1972, the biggest single death toll of a single day of the Troubles, 27 people killed, hundreds injured, and the Justice Henry Barron, who was the head of the Irish Supreme Court, produced the Barron Report, which is well-known in Ireland, but less on this side of the water, which pointed the finger firmly as MI5 for being behind those bombs. And that is the head of the Irish Supreme Court. There are allies in Europe, even though we're leaving Europe. And don't forget that NATO, of which we are a major part of NATO.
Our intelligence services are deeply respected as among the best.
Yes, by the Americans, because we do pretty much what they want. We're very much Operation Cyclone in the 1980s when Margaret Thatcher was in charge. MI6 was the lead agency on supplying jihadi terrorists to Pakistan to be infiltrated into Afghanistan. Okay. We were the lead agency on all of that back in that era.
Final word from you, Mark.
This is necessary. It's not pleasant. I don't particularly like it because I'm a libertarian on it, but we live in a digital age, and I think we need to tackle the digital terrorism and extremism that's out there, and we need to make sure that we're safe. Our intelligence services need this kind of power.
Why are there no protections for lawyers and journalists?
So lawyers and journalists
are not...
I'm answering, don't worry. So lawyers and journalists are completely above all kinds of suspicion then, are they?
No, but they do...
So they're like everybody else.
The lawyers and journalists are just like, I mean, tradition in this country has always been
if you want to
spy on a journalist or a lawyer or a politician, that you have to get very, you know, you have to basically go through all the various checks to do that. So that is not guaranteed with this new charter at all.
This is not a user's full browsing history. This just looks at the communication patterns. This isn't them sitting there looking at everyone they've communicated with. They're not going to raid your email. That's not what this is about.
Okay, well, let's move on to another thing. We were just talking about Northern Ireland, weren't we? The great thing about that, of course, was the Good Friday Agreement, the idea that the Protestants and the Catholics can kind of unite around something which they both agree on. And we had a little bit of this Christian aspect this week at Prime Minister's Questions 2, and also with Theresa May saying that she uses the Bible to help her make decisions. So what are they saying about this at Prime Minister's Questions?
Fiona Bruce.
Comment this week by the Equalities Commissioner not to be worried about talking about Christmas at work. Well, important.
Important.
Because many Christians are now worried, even fearful, about mentioning their faith in public. So would the Prime Minister join me in welcoming the recent Lawyers Christian Fellowship publication, Speak Up, which confirms that in our country today, the legal rights of freedom of religion and freedom of speech to speak about one's faith responsibly, respectfully and without fear are as strong today as ever.
Yeah. Prime Minister.
My honourable friend raises an important issue which matters to both her and me. Yeah, yeah. And I think that the phrase that was used by the Lawyers Christian Fellowship was the jealously guarded principle of that ability to speak freely, as she says, respectfully and responsibly about one's religion. I'm happy to welcome the publication of this report and its findings. Of course, we're now into the season of Advent, and we have a very strong tradition in this country of religious tolerance and freedom of speech, and our Christian heritage is something we can all be proud of. And I'm sure we would all want to ensure that people at work do feel able to speak about their faith and also feel able to speak quite freely about Christmas.
Well, yes, certainly. I don't know if anyone's actually saying you shouldn't be able to speak about Christmas. But I wonder, Mark, is Theresa May from the Lloyd Blankfein, you know, the guy from Goldman Sachs? He said, didn't he, we're doing God's work at Goldman Sachs School of Religion, because it does look as if the crimes of the rich in 2008 are now being, basically, the poor are being told that they've got to pay for them.
So how did you get from Christmas and Christianity to bash the bankers? That's amazing. I thought we were going to talk about religious tolerance. You and I have spoken about the bankers. Yes, I think a lot of them are fraudulent. They should be in jail. I do actually think there is a comment on we're talking about religious freedom and freedom of expression, that actually, yeah, I'm with Theresa May. I think people actually are uncomfortable about talking about Christianity. I think in this country, we have the ability and we should have the ability to talk about religion, but also say what we think about it. And I certainly don't see that. I think some of the... Lewis Smith, when he made those pretty stupid jokes about Islam, I have to say, I don't think there would have been that uproar if he'd mocked Christianity. And I think that's unfortunate.
But what I'm really saying is that Theresa May is talking about Christianity, talking about the Bible, etc. But what's happening is the opposite, that the crimes of the rich are being forced upon the poor. The poor are being told, you've got to pay. We're going to take away your benefits. You know, even if you're working, you're still going to have to pay. Basically, that it seems that there's a kind of...
Again, I'm in vice versa. You managed to get this from Christianity to benefits. I mean, one of them is talking about religious belief. The other one is balancing the economic budget. I wouldn't exactly say they were interwoven,
Martin.
But you do need to balance the budget.
Well, I think what the gist of what I get from what Tony's saying there is, for example, the opposition of the Archbishop of Canterbury to the benefit cap on large families, for example. And it wasn't just him; it was all the major Christian leaders. So, but I think there's a fairly strong tradition in this country of Christian leaders criticising. Conservative governments, and so that's
every government.
Well, yes, but they tend to obviously the interpretation that modern Christians like my family would put on it, not that I'm particularly religious, would be that, you know, the option for the poor, that the people at the bottom of the society's pyramid are the ones that Christ came particularly to speak to and for, you know, there's going to be continual debate about this forever, hopefully.
Okay, I mean, there's a few stories, Mark, might help illustrate what I'm trying to say here. Official report this week reveals the hated benefit sanction scheme costs taxpayers £153 million more a year to run than it saves. This is in the Daily Record in Scotland. £285 million a year to run, but only saves £132 million.
That needs a massively overhauling. I mean, I do think there needs to be some form of sanction.
But so why are they doing it if it's just basically bashing poor people and concentric?
Well, hang on, just on that.
Well, it is.
Quick thing. Yeah. The scheme itself, I can understand where they're trying to go on it. How they're administering it is an absolute failure, and there's got to be reviewed, I would say, on that.
Okay, another one. This is one of these contracts that the government's got. Concentrix was wrong to stop tax credits in 90% of the appealed cases. This is to do with stopping tax credits. And finally...
Yeah, that needs to be...
Finally, more than 250,000 people now are homeless in England. Shelter is reporting this week. You know, it looks as if the poor are having to pay for the crimes of 2008.
Well, I hate to say this again, I'll repeat myself earlier. I'm firmly of the opinion that a lot of these senior bankers basically committed a large fraud, and I would argue that they should be locked up, and I still find it shocking that no one has been.
On a local story, Bristol's four different homeless charities unite to tackle rough sleepers for Christmas. This is good to see. Four different homeless charities and organisations have come together for the first time to pioneer a new way for the city to pay for emergency homeless shelters this Christmas. St Mungo's, the Julian Trust, Caring in Bristol and Crisis Centre Ministries need £100,000 to keep almost 100 people who are currently sleeping out in doorways or tents around the city off the streets over Christmas and the New Year. It's the first time four different charities have worked together. They've now launched an internet crowdfunding campaign which will enable people to donate money directly to them to pay for the beds, meals and hot drinks for homeless people. Four shelters normally offer 70 emergency beds in Bristol, and last week every single one of those was taken. The number of people sleeping on the streets now in Bristol, Martin, 97.
Well, I mean, we all know that there's a housing crisis in Bristol, and we have a regime at City Hall, as we now must call it, with all parties committed to trying to do something about resolving the problem for people on low incomes who can't get decent housing. And if we can get a consensus on what we need to do about that, then we should find it and get on with it.
No, I would agree on it. I mean, one of the things that's always amazed me is, particularly when it comes to winter, because sleeping outside becomes, I mean, it's already pretty damned unpleasant.
Well, it's this week, it's got really cold, hasn't it?
Yeah. No, it's the first time I use my de-icer in anger. Look, I can't understand why we don't make more use of some of the empty office space, why that can't be retrofitted over the Christmas period. There are there. I mean, to be honest, there's an old residential home in my ward that is just sitting there dormant, protected by guardians. I wish some kind of charity would be allowed to go in there and maybe use that over the winter.
Well, you might find some of your electorate not happy with that. I mean, that does happen as well, doesn't it?
It does happen. But I go back to the previous one, we talk about Christianity. This is the time of Christmas.
UK health body proposes removal of speed bumps to cut air pollution. Well, this is who are they?
Never going to happen.
Absolutely crazy sounding idea. They're nice, apparently. National Institute of Care and Care Excellence released a series of recommendations on Thursday this week, said it would promote a smoother driving style and help keep emissions down. Well, free public transport, which would cost £30 million, we heard last week from Tim Kent, that would keep emissions down. Bad idea, Mark?
What, free public transport? If we can afford it, it's great.
But, in Bristol.
It's if you can afford it. For the speed humps, no, they're not. I mean, I don't like speed humps, and actually I think there's some pretty stupid ones out there.
Isn't this a sort of Trojan horse to bring in a congestion charge? Eventually, that's surely what they're going to do.
God, I hope not, and I'll oppose that viciously. No, but the thing is, most of the speed bumps are put around or put down for a reason. You know, I may not like some of our highway engineers that seem to put, in a couple of places, them down willy-nilly, but they're put there for a reason. And, you know, there's some outside schools in my patch that actually are going to need to stay there. I think this is a nice report by Nice, but really, it's not going to happen. I think we can review our speed bumps, but they're there for a purpose. They're there to try and increase safety on the roads.
I understand that there's talk about phasing out diesel cars as well as a way, and it means of getting rid of air pollution. It's a big issue. Transport as a whole needs to be looked at in a holistic way rather than just tinkering at the edges.
Spend that 30 million quid, let's have free public transport, everyone will be leaving their cars at home. Actually, I don't know if you'd be able to fit on the buses.
I'm not sure they would, actually.
They did try and do it in London, of course, but got stopped by the High Court. Finally, education and grammar schools came up at Prime Minister's Questions.
Kelly Tolhurst.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Grammar schools across the Medway towns have provided good education and opportunities for hard-working young people from a range of backgrounds, helping social mobility and intervening to improve recent Ofsted results in local primary schools, particularly in Rochester and Strood. Does my right honourable friend agree that our current grammar school's contribution to education ought to be valued and given every support as part of the educational mix up and down the country to help children achieve their full potential?
Well, I agree with my honourable friend. I believe the figure is that there are now nearly 11,000 more children in good and outstanding schools in my honourable friend's area than there were in 2010. We want to provide a good school place for every child. She references the good work being done by grammar schools in her area to improve the quality of education in primary schools. It's exactly one of the issues we're looking at in our consultation that we're doing on education. We want to remove the legal ban on expanding or opening new grammar schools.
Martin, just one quick word. Why don't Labour support this? It just seems like it's a great way of getting a good education for the poor.
Back secondary moderns for 80% of kids.
Well, OK. Thanks for our guests. Sorry to keep that so short, that last one. Leader of the Conservative Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for Henbury and Brentree, Mark Weston.